Well, today on our plate, 16 through 17, although there are things that I have to go back to from earlier, I did not get to talk about how it is that we are entering a stage of history in which these are where the prophets flourish. So you see over here on the side, I had this up here last time, this is the time of Hosea, Joel, Amos, Isaiah, who we'll talk about in just a minute, Micah, and Jonah. Just to take that last one, remember Jonah is sent to preach to Nineveh. He's sent to preach, in other words, to the capital of Assyria, which is becoming this very intrusive power. And chapter 15, they already start their first deportation, right? The first, as we would call it, the Assyrian captivity. That starts in chapter 15. So it helps you understand Jonah's reluctance. Why is it that you want me to preach to the capital of this enemy country? You know, this would almost be like, you know, sending an observant Jew during the 1940s to Berlin, you know, to go preach, go convert this hotbed of National Socialism. And that's why you hear Jonah's anger after he preaches and Nineveh repents. Remember, that's why Jonah didn't want to do it in the first place. I knew you would pardon them. I knew you were merciful. You can just hear the resentment. But when you read in 2 Kings 15, 16, 17, the incursions and the invasions that the Assyrians are doing, you understand Jonah's resentment. You understand where he's coming from. Maybe we could start by looking at Isaiah 6. If you have your Bible, if you don't, maybe you can peek on a neighbor's. There we go. Where is it? Isaiah 6. Isaiah chapter 6. Okay, Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And he called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people with unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Okay? That vision is happening in the year Uzziah dies. So you are reading about this king where the prophecy of Isaiah begins. There's a fittingness to this happening right in the year of his death. If you look at 2 Chronicles, I think it's in 2 Chronicles. Where is it? Here we go. 2 Chronicles chapter 26. If you have this Revised Standard, it's 336. 336 in the red Revised Standard, if you happen to have this one. But 2 Chronicles 26. Cheerful. It's really cheerful. You're happy people are calling you. Uzziah distinguishes himself in this military conquest against the Philistines and the Ammonites. Brings back booty, that sort of thing. But if you look at verse 16, "For when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction. For he was false to the Lord his God and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. But Azariah the priest went in after him with 80 priests of the Lord who were men of valor. They withstood King Uzziah and said to him, 'It is not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests of the son of Aaron who are consecrated to burn. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have done wrong and it will bring no honor from the Lord God.' Then Uzziah was angry. Now he had the censer in his hand to burn incense, and when he became angry with his priest, leprosy broke out on his forehead in the presence of the priests in the house of the Lord by the altar of incense. And the Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous of the forehead, and they thrust him out quickly. And he himself hastened to go out because the Lord had struck him down. Okay? Very often our teenagers remember the Old Testament. This is the book where people get smited. There's smiting going on. So this is another example of smiting. And this is given in Chronicles. Chronicles supplements, fills out a lot of the things that are not narrated directly. We know that Uzziah is leprous, but we don't quite know why. That isn't quite explained. And so it gives us the background. Now, the reason I bring those two texts is because there's a kind of fittingness in that in the year that the king who violates the temple, who goes in and tries to take over the priesthood, in the year that he dies, that's the year that Isaiah here has this vision of the holiness and majesty of God. Right? So these two things sort of complement each other. On the one hand, you have this violation, intrusion, this king trying to take the Aaronic priesthood to himself. On the other hand, you have this prophet receiving this full vision of what? God's holiness. Please remember that when you hear that term, holy, 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 we think that the angels are maybe getting a little repetitive or they're just stuck. No, Hebrew does not have superlatives. So in other words, you in English you say good, better, best, right? Bad, worse, worsest. But if you're saying better, it's like good, good, and if it's best, it's good, good, good. So if you're saying holy, 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 what that conveys is most holy. That's your superlative, right? Most holy. So, and also now we feel the force of Isaiah's outcry. I am a man of unclean lips among a people of unclean lips. We feel the force of that outcry when, again, we've had the background of what's happening in Judea and Israel as these people are progressively getting worse and worse. If you're like me, this is Kings is not easy to persevere in. I mean, and God bless you for doing so, because you have this starting point with the death of David, the glory of Solomon, and the building of the temple, and now we're in chapters where, for the first time, the temple itself is being threatened. The temple itself is being violated, right? We have Uzziah, but we also now have physically the temple being assaulted. Well, as I say here, worse and worse. If we look at 15, before the reading that we have for today, this captivity happens in stages. So in 15, what we have in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tithlag Pileser, the king of Assyria, came and captured Ijon, Abel Beth Machach, Jonah, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, Galilee, all the land of Naphtali. So in other words, all these territories to the north. Think of like the Sea of Galilee and these areas that are around the Sea of Galilee. They were all carried off. They carried the people captive to Assyria. When you look at a lot of commentaries, what you're doing first is you carry off the notables. You carry off the important people. You don't just haul everybody off. What you do is you take people who are in key positions of leadership, and off they go. Because those are the people that are going to push back and cause you problems. Okay, but later on, as we'll see in 17, there's simply large deportations now. Because in general, when you conquered, and this was not just the Assyrians, there were a lot of people who did this. When you conquered a territory, you wanted to take many of the folks out and plant your own. So if you want one which has had an impact in modern history, in recent history, think about Northern Ireland. Okay, what happened in Northern Ireland is they pushed out a lot of the notables and some amount of the people, and they planted English, Scotch-Irish, they planted it. The British, when they conquered that, they planted all these other people who were reliably Anglican, reliably loyal to the crown. Just think, you remember back to the 70s, remember back to the time of troubles, the bombings and so on, the IRA. That all goes back to the planting of these colonists in Northern Ireland to keep that territory loyal to England. That's the idea. You're taking people out that are potentially trouble and putting people in that are more likely to be loyal to you. And that is what has kept Ireland divided. When I was in Boston, I would see, and it's the only place where I've seen these bumper stickers. You would see these bumper stickers, it would be a map of Ireland, and it would say 32 plus 6 equals 1. The 32 counties of Ireland, the 6 counties of Northern Ireland. That should be 1. You know, that's the only place where I've ever seen those stickers. But that goes all the way back to the colonization of that. Okay? Those people start to be moved out. And the kings, we've already had with the Israelite kings. Remember, the problem with them was they had this alternate center of worship, you know, essentially calf worship, which goes back to Jeroboam. But at the opening, now we have something that is far worse. We're told of Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. He did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the ways of the king of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the abominable principles of the nation, whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Okay, so when they talk about the abominations, there's some commentaries, or there's some scholars for a while that would say Ahaz is imitating the Assyrians. He's kind of being like them. No, the Assyrians didn't carry out human sacrifice. That was not something that was an Assyrian practice. In what he's doing, he's copying the Ammonites and the Moabites. It was those peoples that were these peoples who essentially the Israelites drove out when they came into the Promised Land. So we are going all the way back to, you know, almost to the time of Judges, when the chosen people come in and they're imitating these really demonic practices of these Canaanite peoples and these other peoples who were there before. So when he's sacrificing his child to Moloch, this is beyond what it is the Assyrians would do. And again, it's showing you this regression, that we're not just talking about an alternate center of worship like the calves. We're not just talking about things that are sort of ambiguous, worship in the high places. In other words, you may be kind of trying to worship God, but you're doing it in an unauthorized place. Worse and worse, we are now to human sacrifice. When you look, in fact, earlier there was a passage. It came right at the end of class, and so it was, and it was kind of a puzzle. It's where the Israelites are attacking this guy. I'm trying to remember where this was, and what the king or ruler of the city does is he burns or sacrifices his son on the walls, and it talks about how it is that the Israelites leave in indignation, or they just sort of retreat. Do you remember this? I meant to look this up earlier and forgot to do so. But most commentaries are going to say, you know, the reason the Israelites left, they were really just disgusted that somebody would do this. You know, so to them it was just horrifying that this guy would resort as a tactic to call upon his gods, sacrificing, you know, his own child before them. That was something that was just abhorrent to them. But such is the decline that we now have Ahaz, you know, carrying this out. You know, at a certain point, when you're reading Crime and Punishment, you know, Crime and Punishment is like 800-900 pages. You know, there, I don't know, maybe around page 400, 500, turn yourself in. Turn yourself in already. Maybe at certain points in the narrative, you just say, you know, there's not enough carry. They need more of these folks need to be deported. These people need to be taken away or learned a lesson, because it just gets worse and worse and worse. Aren't the Babylonians here already? So I mentioned about the temple. So let's take a look. The first mention that we have of the temple being violated is not by the Assyrians. It's not by some kind of foreign invader. It's by an Israelite. It's by one of the Israelite kings. So let's see. If you look at chapter 14, starting at verse 11, that gives you the background. Amaziah. Amaziah is the king of Judah, and he's gotten in conflict with the Jehoash, who is the king of Israel. Jehoash, the king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced each other in battle at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. Judah was defeated. Every man fled home. Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Joash, son of Azariah, at Beth Shemesh, came to Jerusalem, broke down the wall for 400 cubits, and from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. Okay, that's again one of the things you do to your enemies. You tear down the wall so they can't defend themselves as well against you in future. And it also has a psychological effect. You just make them feel more vulnerable. He seized all the gold and silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord, in the treasuries of the king house, and also hostages, and returned to Samaria. Okay, this is ominous. This is the first, with all the conflict and all the bad things that have happened, here's the first violation of the temple. And almost the worst thing about it, that it's violated by a king of Israel. In all this warfare that's been going on between Judah and Israel, the temple has not been a target, or the temple has not suffered. But here you have an invasion of Jerusalem, an assault of Jerusalem, tearing down of the walls, and even temple robbery. Okay. Then, once we get to Ahaz, Ahaz is being pressured by the Assyrians. And as we read in verse 5, Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came to wage war in Jerusalem. They besieged Ahaz, but could not conquer him. And at that time, the king of Edom received Elath for Edom and drove the men of Judah from Elath. Okay? So he's under pressure. And Ahaz, we're told in verse 8, took the silver and gold that were found in the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. Okay? So basically, he's in a tight spot, and his idea is, I'm just going to buy him off. I need money, and I got wealth to do that. What am I going to use? There it is. So now, the king of Judah is plundering, right, the temple that his ancestors built. Go ahead.
Did that, in a weird way, actually work out to their benefit in the south, because they were not taken away by the Assyrians, but they were left in place?
Oh, it did. I mean, yeah, it worked. Okay. And that's why one of the things that I was reading over as I was reading on that passage, there was an article I ran into where it talked about how one of the strange things is you would expect that there would be some kind of punishment or retribution to Ahaz. And later on, when they list Ahaz's crimes and list him as a bad person, the selling of the temple vessels, or giving the temple vessels, that's not listed. That isn't something that stands out, you know, in the narrative. It does for Jehoash, you know, that he violated the temple. That is something that comes up. So, in other words, could you make the claim that this guy is just acting as a robber, but the king of Judah, in some way, has some kind of claim in emergencies, you know, to the wealth of the temple? So the commentary may not be Ahaz is a robber like Jehoash, but the commentary may be that this is a guy who has to resort to earthly means or worldly means because he no longer really has the Lord with him. Remember, Ahaz is a guy who's like trying to cover all his bases. So he will have Assyrian worship, he'll have all these different forms of worship, and it's like there are all these gods out there, and somehow if you just get right with all of them, you know, things will work out. Hezekiah, as you read later, in fact, it's particularly sad because, as we're told, let's see, starting at verse 13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, "I've done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose, I will bear." The king of Assyria, what's he going to impose? Money. King of Assyria required Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver, 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the house. Now, here's the particularly, I think, poignant line. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts, which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. In other words, in just almost a kind of an aside, this guy has been trying to rebuild the temple. He's been trying to restore its glory. He's trying to restore its ornamentation, and it doesn't work. He has to end up tearing down the very things that apparently he put up. So Hezekiah is a better example, because this is a king that really is thought of as a good king. He really is thought of as a good. He's commended as a king. And yet, even he has to resort to this expediency. Okay? So, in a way, the situation is clearer with Hezekiah, perhaps, than with Ahaz. You're right. Mrs. Bettina is right to say that it buys him some time. But the very fact that Hezekiah is unable to really give the temple the respect and ornamentation that it deserves shows how far they've come. Okay. And this really does set the stage for the people being taken. Again, you have to go back to the building of the temple, the sense of that the temple is really, on the one hand, yes, God is everywhere. He's the Lord of nature. He's the Lord of the universe. But the temple is the way that he is present on earth, you know, almost like a visible manifestation. The equivalent way, I mean, as a Christian, that when Jesus Christ took on a human nature, that made God visible on earth in a place. Okay, and the temple is, in a way, a preparation for thinking about that incarnation. Right, that God is present in a visible way, a visible, seeable way. That was what the temple was meant to be. So now that the temple is being bit by bit stripped, and then eventually the temple will be destroyed. In Ezekiel, it's the thing in Ezekiel, I think I want to say Ezekiel 10, that Ezekiel has this vision, and it's the thing you usually remember. It's memorialized, for example, in this gospel song, that Ezekiel and the wheel of fire, you know, seeing this wheel. Well, remember what that wheel of fire is this is a vision of something rising up from the temple and going away. And Ezekiel realizes this is the glory of the Lord. This is the Shekinah. The Lord is, Elvis has left the building, right? The Lord has left. The Lord has left. He was in that location. And now things have become so bad that God has left his temple. That's what's in Ezekiel's vision. Go ahead.
I can't remember. Is the ark still there, though, or is the ark already gone?
I think at that point, when the temple's destroyed, then the ark is taken.
But at this point, the ark was still there?
Here, at this point?
Yeah.
To the best of my knowledge.
Oh, okay.
Although that's the strange thing, is I don't know that there's...
It disappeared, right?
Yeah, I don't know that it... well, remember the second temple. So when they come back from Babylon, there's no ark. You know, when they come back from Babylon, it's gone at that point. The second temple doesn't have the ark.
But this is still the first temple.
Yeah, this is the first temple. So the temple, the Babylonians destroy the first temple. And here, you know, that's what I'm saying. That's what's significant here. We're getting little pickings away at the temple. But that's a kind of a foreshadowing of what's going to happen, that the temple itself is going to be destroyed. But the destruction of the temple, that, I guess that's the point I'm making here about Ezekiel, the destruction of the temple is not as sorrowful as the, you know, the loss of the presence of God. Because it's the presence of God that makes the temple what it is. So once the Shekinah has arisen from the temple, once the glory of the Lord is gone, it really is just a building. You know, in Catholic devotional life, it's like on Good Friday when you have the stripping of the altars and you have the tabernacle just left open. And yes, it's consecrated. It's still a consecrated building. But in a way, once the Lord is gone, it's not quite a church, right? The thing that makes it a church is that the Lord in the Blessed Sacrament is present in the tabernacle. And, you know, it's even if you've gone to the thing year after year after year after year, there is something very, you know, very awesome on that Holy Thursday night and then in the Good Friday of just having that empty tabernacle, or Good Friday, and that stripping of the altars. There's something very awesome about that, overwhelming. I haven't mentioned Jeremiah, and I should, because remember, the just by way of reminder, when you look at authorship of the first and second book of Kings, that traditionally is the author of Kings. When you look at Samuel is, by comparison, is a lot more matter of fact. It does not give you kind of explicit judgments about people and about events. Whereas Kings, you're especially seeing it in these chapters. You know, this was a king that was with the Lord. This was a king that was not. And this was what happened to him. And this is how he was, you know, dealt with. That it's much more declarative about God's judgments. And I was reminded because of this phrase, the worshiping under the green tree, the spreading of the green trees. There are certain phrases that occur regularly throughout Jeremiah that also occur regularly in Kings. That's one of the reasons why it is that we believe that they're the same author. And what triggered that was, of course, Lamentations. Lamentations attributed to Jeremiah is, you know, the 5-chapter description of the fall of Jerusalem. And again, after that, you know, at the time of that first captivity, that the loss of the temple, the loss of the city, the carrying off of the people. And again, to refer to the traditional liturgy, Holy Thursday morning, Holy Friday morning, Holy Saturday morning, the morning office. So what it is that the religious are reading and chanting. The readings, the first readings for that are taken from Lamentation. So, and it's meant, the sense of loss that people had about the fall of Jerusalem and the loss of the temple is meant to be carried forward to the crucifixion. It's meant to be carried forward to the crucifixion. That when our Lord speaks of, right, destroy this temple, and on the third day I will rise again, or it will be risen again, that that loss of the temple is meant to be carried through on his death. Okay. Where to next? Yep. Oh, I'm sorry, Karen, go ahead.
On 1734, that's like a restatement of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, as well as the Deuteronomy 6:4, where it says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord."
Mm-hmm.
That whole thing is literally a restatement of, "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall fear the Lord." So it's almost like a restatement of the Ten Commandments. More the first 5, dealing with God and man.
And notice that this this occurs right after the section on Samaria. So starting at verse 24 down to verse 34. In other words, what's the trigger for this restatement? The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, Sepharim, placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the sons of Israel. They took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. And at the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear the Lord. Okay? And they sent lions. The Lord sent lions, which killed some of them. And so, of course, what do? Well, like, we've got our God, so we got to set up something for this God. So that, again, their view of gods is totally local. So if we've got lions that are attacking us, it's not that we're worshiping the wrong God. It's that there's some other God here that needs to be addressed, that needs to be taken care of. So the king of Assyria said, "The nations which have carried you away and placed you in the cities of Samaria do not loathe the God of the land. So therefore he sent lions among them, and they're killing them because they do not know the law of the God of the land." That's their outlook. Each place has kind of its own divinity. So what do the Sumerians do? The king of Assyrians commanded, "Send there one of the priests whom you've carried away. Let him go with no other and teach the law of the God of the land." Okay? So this is when, in the time of Jesus, when the people look at the Sumerians and they just, the Samaritans are just lowlife. You know, hillbilly, trailer. I mean, you can't, you know, that would be the force of it. And why are they lowlifes? They're lowlifes because you're seeing it right here. These are these people, they aren't even really Israelites. They're these people who got dumped here. And yes, they kind of look like they have our religion, but look at how this started. This is just them worshiping God because they think it's the local God to worship. Okay? They just think this is one divinity, but it's not the primary divinity. It's kind of like the divinity you have to placate here. So notice at the end, right before the section that Karen was reading. "So they feared the Lord, but also served their own gods, after the manner of the nations from among whom they've been carrying away. To this day, they do according to their former manner." Okay, so when he's writing this, you know, this happened, you know, however many years ago, and it's still going on. And now we have this. "They do not fear the Lord. They do not follow the statutes or the ordinances of the law." There's this, you're right, it's a restatement of what you see in Deuteronomy, but in this context, it's almost a diatribe. Okay, it's almost a diatribe. However bad the Israelites were, these tribes, they really were people at some level that knew what the law was. They were rebelling, you know, against it. They were faithless, and that's why they got carried off. But they've been replaced by these people who are like, you know, a couple levels down, because they kind of think that they're worshiping the right God. But what they don't get is this thing right here, that this God is the one God. This God is God. This God has just been put into a kind of a pantheon. Okay, one of the objections, historical objections, Ahaz, remember at one point, he pushes into Assyria, or he conquers this thing that belongs to Assyria, and he comes back and he sets up this altar and worships as Assyrian god. And one of the objections was, well, but what sense does that make? If he's conquering the Assyrians, or conquering something that belongs to them, why would he be worshiping an Assyrian god? And I think it's Wordsworth, Christopher Wordsworth, who makes the response, well, but the Romans did the same thing. The Romans would conquer people, for example, the Egyptians, and then they would start importing their gods. Okay? So if you have the idea, you're not going to copy gods that of peoples that you're conquering. We have historical examples of people doing just that. And it's almost like they're finding out about more gods out there, and that was always the problem with polytheism. More the merrier. And that was the thing that the polytheists had such a hard time understanding about Christianity. Why is it that you just want to narrow it to one God? Why? That just seemed senseless to them. Why? You know, it's almost like they look at the world, and of course there are these multiplicity of divine beings out there. You know? That's why it is. You have to explain this when you do, you know, catechism, and you're doing kind of introduction to Genesis with like high scores. Well, if angels are created at the beginning, then why doesn't the Bible say so? Why isn't there a biblical statement about the creation of the angels? Why isn't there a biblical statement and greater clarity about the fall? Okay, remember the context. This is Moses talking to the chosen people. Do you really think it's a good idea for him to tell them there are millions of spiritual beings out there? Okay, that is not something that at the beginning is a good idea. You give information about the angels very gradually so that they're always clear about the primacy of God. When you read the Old Testament, if it just seems to you like angels just come to you bit by bit, there's good reason for that. In a way, you're seeing it right here. These pagan people are not simply able to take this monotheism and take it in. They just turn it into another form of polytheism. You know, it's almost like people work according to to what their understanding is. They work according to a framework that's already there. I remember a priest telling me with some frustration, you know, the bishop wants us to do these consultations. And our bells aren't working. But anyway, real quick to wrap up. This priest was saying, you know, I think a lot of our Catholic people, they don't understand the bishop coming to them and saying, hey, I'm thinking through this plan or this problem. What do you think? Because in a way, they've got this American model. The American model is democracy. We vote on things. So either you're asking me to vote on something, and then you're going to take my vote, or leave me alone. You know? Either I'm voting on or not. That's, you know, you have a certain mental framework by which you approach the world. And if somebody's giving you something outside that framework, it's a little hard to fit it in. They are, these Samaritans are working on the framework they got. Yep?
Are these essentially the same Samaritans that were present in Christ's time?
Yep. Yeah, they are the people in, yeah, they are, no, they're all better. Because remember, they do have this idea, at that point, they're no longer polytheists. But they do have this idea that we're worshiping here, and this is where you're supposed to worship. And you worship in Jerusalem, and you think that's where you're supposed to worship. So no, they don't appear to be, at that point, the issue doesn't appear to be polytheism. It's more, how to put it, it's not a religious difference, it's schism. These are like, it's like schismatic. They look at each other as schismatics. It's more like that. Very good. We'll resume next time.
I was going to bring up your when they go to Babylon, and the Persians kind of bring down that framework of supernatural.